I'm Alice Sheridan. I'm the editorial director for NEPSAP, and I'm here with Dr. Martina McGrath, who's the deputy editor of NEPSAP, and we're both here to interview Dr. Michael Emmett. Dr. Emmett is a professor of medicine and chief of medicine at Baylor University Medical Center and an internationally renowned expert in acid-base disorders. He's authored over 300 papers, contributed to a large number of textbooks, and is the section editor of Fluids and Electrolytes at UpToDate, where I had the good fortune to learn from him for a number of years. We asked Dr. Emmett to write the guest editorial for our up-and-coming issue of NEPSAP on fluids and electrolytes, or electrolytes and acid-base disorders, which will be published sometime later this year. Welcome, Dr. Emmett, and thank you very much.
Thank you, Alice. Let me just make one correction. I'm now the Chief of Medicine Emeritus, and I'm a senior advisor to the Department of Medicine. So I'm still active and still seeing patients and working with residents and teaching.
Are you still doing morning report?
And still doing morning report.
Oh, that's fantastic. So I must tell you, for the guest editor, we obviously try to recruit leaders in the field. And invariably, the first question I get is, Alice, exactly what does the guest editor do? What does it entail? And I think this is because just up until a few years ago, for NEPSAP, the guest editor basically wrote the entire issue, soup to nuts. Which was a boatload of work. And we changed that. Obviously, we have multiple authors contributing to each section of acid base and electrolyte disorders. And so I respond to the query. The job of the editor, the guest editor, is to write on any topic loosely associated with the content of that issue, but perhaps more importantly, write about something that's captured your current interest, something that is near and dear to your heart right now. Generally, that makes for really good writing and fascinating reading, and certainly that was the case here. Dr. Emmett, you wrote about the recently described role of the cystic fibrosis transmembrane regulator, or CFTR, on bicarbonate excretion by the kidney. And I will say your enthusiasm rang through loud and clear and made the topic fascinating. You know, starting with the clinical observation from the Middle Ages and the New York City heat wave, right up to the truly elegant experiments by Peter Berg and colleagues in Dr. Leipzinger's lab. Could you take our listeners through it? Could you tell our listeners the story of why CF patients and CFTR knockout animals become alkalotic in the setting of bicarbonate loading?
Sure. And let me also emphasize that doing the NEPSAP in the past as an editor was an incredible amount of work because Rick Stearns and I were the editors for the fluid and acid base NEPSAP for two volumes of the NEPSAP, I guess the two first volumes. And it was an incredible amount of work. And I appreciate that you've changed that and segregated the work into various compartments. Back to cystic fibrosis, you know, over the past, I guess, 6 or 7 years, we've seen occasional patients admitted to the hospital, adult patients, who have had metabolic alkalosis, and we've figured out that they have mild forms of cystic fibrosis, and then that, you know, encouraged me to look at the literature, and there was certainly a lot of discussion about metabolic alkalosis in children with cystic fibrosis. And young infants with cystic fibrosis. And as you said, this goes back to the 1940s when it was first when this was first described in New York City at Babies Hospital of Columbia University. And my colleagues and I, you know, wondered about why these patients would develop metabolic alkalosis. And it seemed like it was probably related to the fact that they were sweating a lot and became very volume depleted and became hypokalemic, losing potassium in their sweat. And the combination of hypokalemia and volume depletion generated the metabolic alkalosis. But it didn't entirely all fit. And I was fascinated by all these recent observations and studies that have been done primarily in Europe. As you mentioned, but Dr. Berg has published a lot of these studies. and made a lot of these discoveries. And it turns out that there are some very fascinating, there's a very fascinating role for CFTR, the genetically abnormal transporter that we've known that was very important in sweat ducts and in the GI tract. But now we learned that it's a very important transporter in the kidney as well. And defective CFTR clearly is responsible for a large proportion of why patients will develop metabolic alkalosis if they have cystic fibrosis, why they're predisposed to this complication. So it's a fascinating integration of clinical findings and renal pathophysiology.
Yeah. Obviously, your editorial noted that CFTR is expressed in beta intercalated cells, and its expression is necessary for pendrin function. How is CFTR modulating pendrin function? Now, this is a kind of leading question. Certainly, studies have suggested that CFTR increases both protein expression, or at least apical localization, but also activity. And Berg and his colleagues also speculate that CFTR function ensures an adequate level of luminal chloride.
So the beta intercalated cells, when they were first identified as specific types of transport cells in the more distal parts of the kidney, have this very unique protein called pendrin, which exchanges bicarbonate. It secretes bicarbonate into the lumen in exchange for chloride, and so it clearly has an important role to play if the body's trying to get rid of bicarbonate. And there must be some chloride in the lumen for that exchange to occur. And I guess all of us always assumed that the chloride was there because it wasn't completely reabsorbed in more proximal parts of the tubule. But it turns out that CFTR is also very important in terms of actually moving chloride into the lumen, where it's available for exchange with bicarbonate by pendrin. So that's one of many potential important roles for CFTR in that part of the kidney. It also turns out that CFTR is important for just generating and inserting pendrin into the luminal membrane, because animals, at least mice with mutations in CFTR, don't have normal pendrin activity or insertion into the luminal side of the beta intercalated cell.
Ah, that's interesting. I was wondering whether, so is it a trafficked protein? Is it a localization phenomenon, do you think?
I don't think that's really clear yet, but there certainly is an interaction in terms of inserting pendrin into the membrane. And then the other thing that became, really fascinating over the past, several years is the role of the intercalated cells, specifically beta, or type B rather, intercalated cells, and perhaps also non-type A, non-type B intercalated cells, in volume regulation and the reabsorption of sodium chloride in the more distal parts of the kidney. And that was kind of a surprising finding, but it's become very, very important. We always assumed the intercalated cells were there almost entirely for reasons of acid-base balance to either secrete protons or bicarbonate. But it turns out that the beta intercalated cells are really important for the reabsorption of sodium chloride. And so that obviously plays an important role in a patient with cystic fibrosis who's sweating a lot and becomes volume depleted and is stimulated to reabsorb salt and water. The beta intercalated cells would normally play a major role there. And also, really fascinatingly, the reabsorption of sodium chloride in water by the beta intercalated cells occurs independent of potassium secretion. And we've always known that the principal cells reabsorb sodium and in an indirect way result in potassium secretion. And so the reabsorption of salt by the principal cells seems to put a significant amount of potassium into the lumen and then into the urine. And that obviously would be a big problem if you're already very hypokalemic and want to retain potassium in the body. And the beta intercalated cells turn out to be the site where that can happen, where a lot of salt can be reabsorbed without potassium secretion. And when that goes awry in a patient with mutations in the CFTR gene, you wind up losing potassium in the urine. So it was really fascinating. These recent discoveries have really explained a lot of the clinical findings that we see in these patients.
Yeah, it reminded me a little bit when I was reading, particularly about the luminal chloride requirement. When the causative mutations for Barters were described from Rick Lipton's lab, remember the gene encoding the sodium potassium chloride cotransporter was first identified, which was kind of the obvious one. But
Right.
then the genes for ROMK and basolateral sodium potassium ATPase, both of those which ensure adequate potassium that allows for the apical cotransporter activity. I guess it pointed out the numerous genes and proteins and transporters that are involved in the subtle changes that make a difference.
Yes, absolutely. And I've been in nephrology since 19, I guess, let's see, 1974, when I became a nephrology fellow. And the explosion of our understanding of physiology and pathophysiology in the kidney has been absolutely phenomenal and difficult to keep up with, because it seemed like every day we were making new discoveries, and it's really an exciting field.
Yeah.
I find it fascinating
Me
and
too.
difficult to stay ahead of.
I completely agree. I had to read your editorial and Dr. Berg's work a number of times before I could I understood it completely. And it's pretty much the same every time I tackle acid base and electrolytes.
And I'm sure there's going to be a lot of new findings over the next 2 or 3 years that'll make it even more interesting and more complicated.
Yeah, exactly. But also, as you point out, I always thought the best medical stories start with careful clinical observation. And in fact, to be a good clinical observer was as important to our understanding of physiology and pathophysiology as performing a genetic screen, performing an assay. I personally think case reports continue to be extremely important for this reason. And you gave classic examples, the observation that a child, I'm paraphrasing here, a child that tasted salty when kissed was likely to die, referring to the CF mutation, or obviously the sensitivity to heat during the New York City heat wave in 48. And yet I was surprised by the identification, the role of secretin. And I'm wondering whether you think secretin's role is limited to the alkaline tide, or does it play a broader role in alkalosis?
I'm sure that physiology is a lot more complicated than we understand at any given point in time, and I have no doubt that secretin is going to be an important hormone, and the secretin receptor is an important factor in terms of the body's response to metabolic alkalosis. And Berg certainly thinks that's the case, and is doing studies in that realm.
Does it go up with alkali loading?
I don't know,
Okay.
and if that's been looked at. I haven't read that yet, but I wouldn't. That's certainly the hypothesis that the Berg lab is proposing.
Yeah, that would be fantastic. I mean, it would be, I don't, is there another systemic protein that can alter acid base? Something that is outside the kidney.
Well, renin and aldosterone certainly,
Fair enough. Okay. Yeah. That is, and certainly
and.
ADP is another corollary there.
Right. But the secretin story and the alkaline tide story is fat. I think these areas are just fantastic. They're the way they integrate physiology and pathophysiology with renal physiology.
It is. So one of the things I was wondering, and it was getting back to, is starting with a careful clinical observation. Now there's a bit of a tendency to use kind of a shotgun approach to identifying causative genes with genetic screening. It's very easy to get a genetic screen on patients. It's far cheaper than it used to be, and we often get a list of variants of unknown significance that we retrofit to a clinical presentation. On one hand, this could contribute to the explosion in data and our understanding. But what do you think? Will the genetics approach enhance our understanding of physiology, or will we lose something along the way?
Oh, I'm sure that it will enhance things, but it's important to not lose sight of the fact that understanding physiology and pathophysiology is I think equally important, and integrating those two domains is the way to go, I think, going forward. The geneticist and the physiologist need to get into the same room and integrate their findings.
Sure. I'm hoping it will be nephrology fellows and scientists who drive that actually.
Well, certainly, yes, certainly. So do I. And the kidney and renal physiology and pathophysiology is a wonderful domain to try to integrate those kinds of things.
It is. One of the things that struck me, these studies required such laborious hands-on work. The experiments were require real skill developed over years in a wet lab, single cell pH measurements and isolated perfused tubules. We notice fewer and fewer fellows seem to be gravitating to the basic science. Most of our fellows at Brigham Mass General, those who are interested in research are far more interested in more immediately clinically relevant outcomes research, which requires a completely different skill set. Have you noticed this at Baylor? And do you think it will limit progress in our understanding of basic science?
Well, at Baylor Medical Center, I'm at Baylor in Dallas, and we don't have a great deal of basic scientific research going on. And our fellows are really almost entirely focused on clinical nephrology, and planning to mostly enter practice or become clinical investigators at a very clinical level, not at a basic science level. And my hope would be that the fellows at places like the Brigham and institutions like that, that there would be a proportion of those individuals who would be interested in very, basic science, wet lab kind of research. As you say, there's also a lot of research going on in terms of the areas of epidemiology and just sitting at a computer and generating data and ideas. Without ever, moving away from your computer. And that's important too, but I think there's no doubt that the kind of research that the Berg team has been doing has really advanced our knowledge in this area and would have never have happened without pathophysiology being investigated at the tissue and cell level.
I would add to that. I'm hoping it will continue to be clinician observations that make connections, as you did, in a particular case or a series of cases of CF patients who are alkalotic. I'm hoping that will also drive some inquiry.
And let me also mention Peter Berg, it's Petter Berg, I guess, has written a number of fascinating papers in this area. But he's been doing all of his work in Jens Lepsinger's lab in Denmark, in Aarhus. I'm not sure in Aarhus. I'm not sure how you pronounce that city. That's been a real. There's been an explosion of information from that laboratory. And Berg has been the lead investigator in a lot of that, but not all of it.
Martina, any questions?
This has been a fascinating discussion. As a non-transport or salt and water person in nephrology, I've been learning a lot. Dr. Emmett, I guess bringing this back a little bit towards the clinical side, you mentioned in your editorial about the role of the new CF drugs, the CFTR correctors and CFTR potentiators. Do you see these as a potential mechanism to help prevent the severe kind of volume depletion that was seen in these patients previously before these drugs were available?
They certainly seem to work in terms of preventing or ameliorating the tendency to develop metabolic alkalosis when you either get a bicarbonate load or get another type of bicarbonate stress. I think obviously their role is so much more dramatic in children with severe CF affecting their GI tract and pulmonary function, the kids who would die at a young age of CF or need a lung transplant. And these drugs have been absolutely miraculous in terms of enhancing the quality of life and expanding life expectancy in those children and young adults. But they clearly have a role here as well. You know, the prevention of metabolic alkalosis is important, but it also can be achieved by avoiding dramatic sweating in hot environments. That seems to be the major factor, at least in the adult patients who have these mild forms of CF. And I don't think these drugs, which are, you know, are very expensive, would be used in that situation. I think it would be a much more of an effort to just avoid excessive sweating and ingesting large amounts of potassium and sodium chloride if a patient does sweat, rather than using these drugs. But Berg is, you know, in the Annals of Internal Medicine paper did show that taking these drugs improves the ability of the kidney to excrete bicarbonate. And so they certainly would work. I just don't think, at least at this point in time, that would be a major role for them.
I think he also mentioned it could be used as a screening, as a more accurate or at least a less expensive screening test for CF, which could be hugely.
Yeah, that's what they're proposing. You know, especially in, you know, these days, at least in most countries, most developed countries, neonates screen for the most common CF mutations routinely, and so the diagnosis is being made much, much earlier. And I think, you know, we'll be seeing at least the babies with metabolic alkalosis as the presenting sign of or feature of CF is going to become increasingly uncommon, because the children are going to be diagnosed before that happens, at birth. But there still may be many mutations that we haven't yet uncovered or aren't going to be tested for. And those that produce milder forms of CF, patients will have these, will carry these mutations and seem to be perfectly healthy into adult life. It seems like the men are almost always azoospermic, at least all the ones that have been described, the adults. But I think in those individuals, I don't think these drugs would certainly work. I just don't think at this point they'd be very practical in terms of their use in that situation.
I would wonder whether there may be countries, populations where they don't have the resources to do genetic screening, and perhaps.
Well, absolutely. And I think the big studies coming out of, you know, Turkey and the Middle East, where screening isn't as it's uniform as it is, or it's as extensive it is as it is in Europe, in Western Europe and the United States, more of these children are being with metabolic alkalosis continue to be discovered in that way. Whereas in the United States, I think that's going to become increasingly uncommon because the diagnosis will be made at birth or soon after birth.
Well, thank you very much. I think that's all of our questions, and I think we're just about running out of time.
Well, I encourage the nephrologist to read it, to read the article, because even if they never see another cystic fibrosis patient, I think they'll gain a lot of information and knowledge about the way the kidney handles bicarbonate and volume that may well be very important in normal individuals and individuals with other types of diseases, not mm-hmm. just cystic fibrosis.
Well, I'm sure they will, actually. I'm sure they'll read your editorial with interest. So thank you for your skills as your expertise, but also your skills as a teacher. It's truly appreciated.
Well, thank you. And I appreciate your interviewing me this morning. And this article was really a kind of a labor of love. I really enjoyed doing this because I learned so much about this unusual, for me, an unusual disease. I don't have patients with cystic fibrosis myself, but the pathophysiology and the physiology expands throughout all of humanity.
Excellent.
Thank you, Dr. Emmett.
You're welcome. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye now.
This podcast is copyrighted by the American Society of Nephrology. All rights reserved. All content in this podcast is for informational purposes only and is not intended to be medical advice. This podcast should not be used in a medical emergency or for the diagnosis or treatment of any medical condition. Please consult your doctor or other qualified healthcare professional if you have any questions about any medical condition or before taking any drug, changing your diet, or commencing or discontinuing any course of treatment. Thank you for listening to this podcast from the American Society of Nephrology.